Welcome to the Do Deals Get Rich podcast.
The two rules to buying any business.
Making the barrier to entry just so easy.
Here's how you get your money back.
That was really good. We got a buddy of mine. A lot of people are actually calling him the Pharaoh of FedEx routes, is what I've been hearing along just on Twitter and stuff. Adam Decker, who went to law school with me, a good buddy of mine. And so we're excited to have you on, bro, and just learn. So right now you're a partner at Decker Getch, industrial warehouse developer. But you've also just recently done a acquisition on the side as a little, not little, as a big side hustle to do. And so I'm excited to get into it with you.
Yeah, for sure. Stoked to be here, bro.
Good.
That's what you're saying. Reminded me of our, I was thinking this morning of a local snag, bro. was that what it was called?
Yeah, that's right, dude. Local snag.
The old antiquing gig we were spinning there in Chicago, man.
Did you ever go to any of the antique stores with me?
Absolutely. I remember going and like awkwardly pretending like we were interested in antiquing. Right. And like looking at antiques and being like, oh, yeah, this mirror is really
so just for context,
are you interested in using our online platform?
Yeah. So for context, my brother had devved out a site that he'd spent like $100,000 on before getting any user data whatsoever, any feedback. And so it was Local Snag, which was supposed to be a competitor to eBay, where antique stores list their inventory on Local Snag, and it was like geo-based. So the idea was you could find local antiques with online inventory instead of having to go to eBay to do it. So Decker and I worked out a deal with my brother where if we were to ever get users, we would get equity in Local Snag. It's the old no money down for equity game, and turns out when you try to become a salesman on a project that's been dev'd with no user feedback whatsoever, it's a little bit of an uphill grind.
I remember, like, I think I was second year, you were third. I was like, this is my chance, dude, to partner with the Williams boys, dude. This is it, man. This is my ticket. Local Snag is it.
So. It was little, just, you know, that's the thing that's important is like being right, but early is still being wrong. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like in terms of partnering with me, bro, like totally right. And the thesis, sure. just early. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I hear that, dude.
So you have a background in mergers and acquisitions, real estate, obviously doing that. And we had kind of talked about FedEx routes a little bit. You've been looking at it. But even before like the FedEx specific thing, what was the thing that got you thinking about doing an acquisition apart from like your main thing, which is developing industrial warehouses? What was the like idea there buying something as opposed to like hustling and starting something from scratch?
I left a law firm with three kids and one on the way, and it was a big risk to do that. And I remember moving out here to California, and then like I moved in January, and then COVID hit in March, right? And I was like, oh crap, this is a scary time to have left the law firm. Yeah. And it turns out in hindsight, it was a phenomenal time to get into industrial real estate. So it worked out. But like the nature of real estate development, it's very much like you hit a big deal and you get a, you know, pile of cash, and then you don't really know when the next big deal's coming.
Yeah.
And my wife and I were sort of coming from an environment where we were like used to that steady paycheck,
right?
Paying the mortgage, covering our expenses. And I love real estate and I want to stay in it, and I don't want to be forced to do crappy deals.
Yeah.
So I this was more of a, hey, let's figure out a way to put money to work. And if it takes up time in my week, so be it. But I do want something that gives me steady cash flow so I can kind of like fund our life.
Yeah.
And then still pursue sort of big hits in real estate. So
yeah, it's awesome.
So that's how it all started. And yeah.
Just from context, what was the ultimate size of the deal or like the seller, like the EBITDA of what you bought?
The FedEx business?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, we sold it or we bought it for $4 million, EBITDA $1
million. Awesome.
Yeah.
4X.
So it was a 4X multiple. Okay. We closed April 2nd. We got 80% financing from a bank out of Shreveport, Louisiana, of all places.
Was it an SBA?
Yeah, so I spent some time in Shreveport.
An SBA loan or just like a local bank?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're familiar with the region, the Arklatex, dude.
The what? But, what did you say? The Ozarks? Did you say the Ozarks?
It's a region, dude, between the tri-state area of Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, kind of that area.
Yeah.
The locals call it the Arklatex, dude.
No, so, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I think like maybe three people call it that, but but it really went over big with this bank. So the route we found was in Little Rock, and kind of like two owners prior had used this bank out of Shreveport to finance their business, and so we sort of got introduced to them. And instead of sort of reinventing the wheel with financing, we thought, hey, this bank out of Shreveport knows the business. They know this specific region. They know the FedEx space. I mean, why try to go convince one of the bankers we use in real estate?
Yeah.
Why try to educate them on FedEx where right. we could just go like use these guys who already know the space and are familiar with the region. And so that was sort of the angle we took.
But it wasn't an SBA loan. It's like a bank. No. Like it was just like a bank. It was basically, so you basically like refied the owners out of the, or like a refinancing type deal.
Yeah.
Cause were they the current lenders to, it was two previous owners that had that bank, and then yeah. the new owners had a different bank, and then you went back to the first bank.
So the actual seller had already paid off the notes.
Got it.
Our seller had already paid them off. He had assumed the notes from this bank. Mm-hmm. But the prior owner was really close with this bank, and he was sort of helping the seller as a consultant.
Crazy.
And so he's the guy who introduced us. So
did on the financing piece, so non-SBA, what does that look like? Like if they don't have the SBA to backstop them, which is probably awesome because you also aren't subject to all of the SBA lending requirements. Like, did they make you do personal guarantees, like personally guarantee the full loan, like anyone who had over 20%? Do you know like how different it was from like a normal SBA process of like, I mean, an SBA is typically like, yeah, I mean, the big one that people try to get out of is just like fully personally guaranteeing the loan. That usually is like the thing that you try to avoid as much as possible. So did they make you personally guarantee it?
Yeah.
And it's you and your brother.
Guaranteed the loan, so it is guaranteed. Yeah, it's me, my brother, and my dad bought into it.
Oh, all three.
So the three of us bought it, and we're all three on the note. And yeah, unlike a real estate loan where you have the real estate collateral, you know, right. just pretty easy to assess. Here, like the only collateral you have is the value of the trucks, right?
Yeah.
So we did a stock purchase. We acquired the business, which owned. I think we own like 8 to 9 vehicles, right? And so that has a certain collateral value, but not $3.2 million worth sure. of collateral value, right? So yeah. the lenders have to get comfortable with, okay, how are we going to make up the delta? And that comes from personal guarantees. We had to pledge some collateral too, just from, you know, stocks and bonds and stuff that we own. But
yeah.
For us, it was worth it because it was like, gee, this is a lender that we can get into the space with, 4% loan.
Cool.
I mean, it was great.
4%, so, is it a 10-year term, 30-year, or like 30-year term, 10-year balloon?
7-year.
Seven year, like fully, yeah. Like fully amortized. No balloon or anything.
No balloon payment.
What
fully amortized?
What was it about? Because we had spoke about FedEx a couple months ago. What was it that ultimately made you decide to become the FedEx Pharaoh? How did you get to the top of the pyramid that you now are perched on?
You know, I'm currently floating on the waters of the Nile, so to speak, right? As the Pharaoh of the FedEx.
The shipping
now that
Nile.
I'm here, I don't know.
You never liked it
because you could never control the top line. I remember that.
Yeah, totally.
I remember talking to you about it. You were like, I freaking hate this, bro. Like, I can't control revenue. Screw this, dude. I'm over it.
No,
I want to like hire teenage carnies to help in my like escape room. So I get we don't have control over the top. Our only customer is FedEx. That part of it is good and bad. The great thing is like every single week FedEx pays us, right?
Totally.
For the miles we run for them. So it's like a very steady ACH deposit in our bank account every Friday morning. It's very predictable cash flow.
Yeah.
Which is why I think we could get such a great loan on it.
So it's
super bankable from that side.
When you bought it, were you thinking more of like, this is something that I'm going to get into operationally and I'm really going to grow it because I feel like there's like underutilized capacity that I really want to like sink into, or this is very stable and I can do very little and like it's really hard to mess up the stability of it?
The latter, for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe someday when I learn the space, I'll be able to find sort of like an opportunistic buy. But for our first one, especially, we targeted, you know, businesses that had great books and great finances so that we could get finance.
Totally.
A lot of contractors in this space don't keep their books up. And so it's hard to get a lender comfortable to lend on it. And so we targeted one that had an awesome manager in place. So he's a rock star. Like he manages all of our trucks, all of our drivers, all of our runs. So we do some of the administrative work, but like day to day, he's there doing boots on the ground. And so you can make the case that maybe 4X was a high valuation, but I don't regret it because it got us into this space. We're learning a ton and there's still so much room for error with the margins that we have that, I don't think twice about it. Yeah.
Do you, what was the process for you to get comfortable, like operationally, like with the I'm sure like you probably feel some key man risk of this manager of who he is and if he were to bail.
Yeah.
What was the process, I guess, for you personally to get you and I guess the partnership to get comfortable with that risk operationally in the business? And then also secondarily from like the bank getting comfortable with y'all without the operational experience and like whether that was a process or not.
No, that was a big issue for the bank. So from the bank perspective, the red flags were like, we're real estate people. We don't know what we're doing with trucking. Right. And we tried to pitch them like, we build warehouses, trucks drive to warehouses, same thing.
We use gas stations. You know, like trucks use gas stations.
Right. Exactly. It's all the same, you know. And they sort of laughed and said, "Yeah, okay." But and then on top of that, I'd flown out to Shreveport from California, and so there's this like, "Whoa, what are you doing coming from California out here? Yeah. Like, you don't know Arkansas, right? You don't know the Arklatext, right?" So. And then I had to pitch them on, no, I had grown up in Dallas. I know the region. And so it took some work there. Candidly, having that, you know, the kind of consultant guy who had owned the business, you know, prior to our seller, you know, he came and met with the lender with us, right? Which was huge. And so he was able to help get them comfortable because he stayed on 60 days after closing to kind of help us as a free consultant. So he sort of helped us through this kind of interim period as we get our sea legs.
And he was doing that as an advisor to the seller. Like he was basically brokering for the seller. He was trying to get a transaction. Yeah. He was trying to get the transaction done.
Yeah.
And you, in terms of finding this business, because I know there are, especially in like FedEx specific routes, right? You'd sent me to some sites and people that do content around that. Is that how you found this? Is that how you found the deal amongst the, like at the very beginning process?
Yeah. So I went to Route Consultant. It's this guy, Spencer Patton, who, based out of Nashville, like he was in a hedge fund. And then he was like, I kind of want to run my own business. So he started buying FedEx routes. And then he was like, okay, I love operating them. I can avenue by creating content, courses, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And so I paid for that and he taught me a lot. But what's great
is for the courses and the content and stuff.
Yeah, I did. Cool. Yeah. Through Route Consultants. I mean, definitely worth it. Cause there's so much like industry specific stuff
for sure.
Right. That I mean, I wouldn't know. Right. But it's cool. Cause it's like, it's such a big industry. There's like a little cottage industry. Like we just hired a bookkeeper to do our books and she exclusively does the books for like only FedEx contractors all around the country.
Yeah.
And so she like knows, I mean, she just kind of just cranks through it, knows exactly what each line item, you know. Like, and so there's that, there's specific vendors that you got to know and get familiar with. There's conferences and Route Consultants sort of help my brother and I get familiar with the space and comfortable to pull the trigger.
What's kind of the divvying up of responsibility between the three of you, your brother and your dad? Like is somebody operations, somebody's more back office, finance? I assume your dad's probably more just like passive, whatever. So how do y'all think about like last line of defense and how y'all divvy it up between you and your bro?
Rick's, I don't even know that.
Who's your dad? Rick is your dad.
Yeah, that's my, Rick's my dad. Sorry, Rick's not really involved day to day at all.
Yeah.
He's really good at real estate and he was sort of like, excited about this just for the journey, right?
Totally.
And wanted to make a buck, but he's less interested in sort of learning a new space as Joseph and I are. Joseph's my brother, by the way.
Cool.
Joseph just graduated from business school. And so he's sort of, I mean, between this and real estate, this is sort of like his gig too. So he's more of like the finance guy. Like he'll handle all of our payroll. He'll handle managing our books. Just out of necessity, he handled a lot of our insurance issues. Mm-hmm. But like once we're sort of up and running, there's not much other than just general administrative work to do.
Right.
And so
assuming
like,
the operator doesn't quit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So week by week from us as like remote owners, we got to handle payroll. We got to handle, we got to submit stuff to FedEx to make sure that they're paying us for the miles we run.
Yeah.
We got to be compliant with a couple stuff just from a DOT perspective, from having trucks, all that crap. We want to take off the plate of our manager because we want him focusing on the business.
Yeah.
A big part of what we do too is recruiting. You know, the drivers we have CDL licenses, but they're still like high turnover, right? Like, and so it's a constant game of trying to recruit new drivers to come and drive for you because like even in just since April 2nd, right? We had one driver leave probably 2 weeks ago. Right. And so it's like, dang. And when you only have six runs, that's a big deal. Yeah.
Cause that run will be shut or like somebody's working overtime. Like it's like run, hurry up offense to like get labor right sized or else you're screwed.
Yeah, ideally our guys are driving, they drive at night. So ideally they're driving five nights a week, but with one guy, we're one guy down. So most of them are driving six now. Right. And so it's like,
yeah,
driving six nights a week, not really sustainable long-term, right? You can do it in a pinch, but like we sort of got to get on it to find a new guy. And the FedEx requirements are so high, you got to do background checks on all your drivers.
Right.
It's like, it's tough to find someone that'll qualify. So that's a challenge.
When you were talking, what was the seller's motivation to exit the business? Just tired, like
ready to be done, or? Yeah, older guy, smart guy. He was the largest franchisee of Massage Envy at one time in the country. Sold that to a private equity fund and then got into the FedEx space. So he was based out of Nashville and he owned two businesses in Little Rock and one in Texarkana, one in Charlotte, I believe, too. But he just started selling these businesses off, you know, piecemeal.
Yeah.
Because he wants to spend more time with his kids, kind of the end of his career. So kind of that vibe. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I it's interesting, like, because I didn't obviously come from the franchise world, and I've always kind of like in my head going from like pure entrepreneurship to from like law to pure entrepreneurship. I always thought of like franchisees as like, oh, like they're not real, like dyed in the wool entrepreneurs. You know what I mean? Like, because they didn't they didn't struggle with what the logo colors were like I did. Like that was just given to them. And then in Texas, I met some like loaded, one of my best friends was like the CEO of this conglomerate that owned a bunch of Domino's pizzas. And like, it's interesting, like that version of entrepreneurship that is like, that's like way simpler and like a much easier, definitely when you're looking for something that's just like solid passive cash flow, which is like a totally sensible strategy, like franchises and like things like this, where like you don't have to, what I learned from him is like the idea that like, if you don't really love operations, like franchising can like solve a lot of your issues. If you, I mean, you still got to do underwriting on like who the franchisor is, but I think the strategy of like going in, like buying into franchise systems, as just like a, I'm going to do this passively. I'm not going to like really spend a bunch of time into it. I think it makes a ton of sense. And I think it's interesting that you see a lot of these guys that are in franchise systems and like really crush it. Like, if you invest in the right platform, like you're doing in this FedEx thing, and maybe you'll get into it and find something different. But like, once you understand the platform, like it's really easy to be an investor in the franchise systems, as opposed to trying to be an entrepreneur, like starting everything from scratch and like having to solve every issue under the sun in order to build something that's scalable and hope that like you can scale that.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I mean, you had success with Alcatraz. You've had success with Carly's Brands. I've had zero success with developing brands on my own. between Local Snack, Golf Be Dead, my random just run failed people. Ventures.
So let's talk about the difference between... Let's talk about the difference between... Well, you had the Stoic thing. The Stoic thing had legs if you had stuck with
that
it.
That actually had some legs, too.
So like talk about the difference in how you think about like acquisition entrepreneurship, we'll call it, versus like start from scratch entrepreneurship and the stuff that you've done.
Yeah, I actually, there's a term for this. My brother just said it when we were in Little Rock last week. He called it ETA.
Entrepreneurship through acquisitions, bro?
Yeah. I felt like a tool for having to be like, what does that mean, dude?
Oh, it's just so business schools can like charge for a class on it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But it's a whole space, right? No, like, so I guess your question's like, what's the, I mean.
Like, could you see your, like me, now, now that you're doing this, could you see yourself, if you get a new idea, like, do you still feel like you have that in you, or you're kind of like, like, creativity aside, like, this feels like the model that, like, fits my lifestyle better?
I mean, 100% fits my lifestyle. Like, had I maybe gotten into entrepreneurship when I was 18 with no kids and no, like, real commitments,
yeah,
right, then maybe I can eat ramen, live in a, you know, trailer. I don't know why I jumped to trailer.
I feel like there's a middle ground there.
I guess you don't have to live in a trailer, but, you know, you know, the whole, like, the entrepreneur as a martyr, right, for his
cause, bootstrap.
I feel like that's, that's great. And for some it works, and I think that's amazing. But for me, I kind of came out at it like I left a really good job that I didn't hate. I know you hated the law firm. I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, I thought it was interesting. It was hard at times, but I thought it was a good job.
Yeah.
But now that I've, like, done it and I've acquired the FedEx space, like, there's enough, like, of an impact I can have on the business to where I scratch that creative itch. Like, I don't feel, does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Like, I get that I'm under the FedEx brand, but there are so many managerial decisions that we got to make that I feel like that itch is sort of scratched.
Was that a part of your, was that a part of, like, your diligence process of, like, understanding what do I have control over? I'm trying to kind of, like, get to this idea of, like, you know, I typically tell people that you need to invest in something that's in your core competency, right? Something that you can understand, like, and focus in on developing that core competency, because, like, once you need to get to the point where you need to make the bet and you need to go all in, you'll be so much more confident. You'll be so much more confident in the bet if you're doing something that you feel competent in. So I'm just, like, trying to get an idea of, and obviously you invested, right? You invested in a course and, like, the information to, like, build this out. Like, this isn't part of your natural competency. Obviously you have a lot of experience in law and doing deals and, like, and taking on debt, right? All of those things you've had exposure to. And so what was the, like, how did you go from FedEx routes? That's interesting. I know nothing about that, which is kind of like where you met me at, right? You're like, what do you think about this? I'm like, I don't know. I know nothing about it. To, like, pushing past that and to, like, no, I'm going to keep drilling down on this and, like, keep figuring out if this is something that I want to, like, take a big bet on.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think it just goes back to my motivation. Like, I wanted something. My dad always oversimplifies, but he always, like, he describes the world in terms of hunters and farmers.
Totally, right? Which is awesome.
And hunters they're in it for the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hunters are in it for the deal. They eat what they kill. I'd say, like, a real estate broker is, like, your quintessential hunter, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't close a deal, they don't eat, right? And that's, like, for some, that's great. For others, it's super, right? And a farmer is the opposite end of the spectrum. Maybe you don't make as much money, but it's super consistent, super steady. Your responsibilities are very clear and straightforward.
Yeah.
And it's predictable, right? And for some, that works too. And I'm coming from a space with real estate development. Like, maybe it's not 100% hunter, but it's still a hunter because you're taking a lot of risk. And the interesting part is the deal, not so much like managing a fully stabilized warehouse, right?
Right.
Like, that doesn't really get me going, but the deal mechanics does. And I wanted something just to provide some cash flow to be able to facilitate the hunter in me. Right. And so I view this fact as, like, you know, maybe I don't love the farming aspect of it, but it enables me to pursue the hunting that I want to in real estate.
Totally.
And so I kept drilling down and I started looking at it. And I'm like, look, I mean, what's really the downside here is e-commerce going anywhere
right
over the next 30 years. I mean, no, I'm borrowing 80% of the purchase price. If I really suck at operating this thing, I can always sell it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still residual value for this thing.
Yeah.
There's clearly a marketplace for this business. And so worst case scenario, maybe I don't earn, maybe I lose some of the money that I put into it. But I mean, I don't really stay up at night thinking that I'm going to have to like pay off the entire loan.
Right. Yeah.
Before it came to that, we just sell the business and move on. Right. But I looked at it as like, you know, a lot of upside. If you can stabilize this, especially if you pay off the loan in 7 years, then it's just all cash flow. And it's like, gee, like that's a pretty great business. And we're already starting to look to the next one. And it's like, if you can own two or three of these, I mean, that's a pretty incredible little, I don't want to call it a side hustle. Cause that's, I mean, I feel like that's overused and it's more than a side hustle for me, but it's steady cash flow for sure.
Yeah. What, where do you feel like your loan capacity taps out? Like for the next one? Do you feel like you could like keep going with either this lender or someone else as long as you got the 20% down? Or you feel like from a personal guarantee, like that ratio to like the collateral that you have that you start maxing out?
No, that's a great question. And one that like Joseph and I are constantly asking ourselves, because it's like, we're already providing guarantees on some of our construction projects, right? Like for construction loans. And so there's some risk you're taking there.
I guess all those guarantees
Are
all those guarantees kind of off the book? Like, are they filing UCC ones on like you individually? Like, or is it just kind of like off the books? Like no lender really sees any of it. And then like you default and then like, they're like, what the shit? This guy was like 100x levered. I mean, if you're already
it's more that scenario. Yeah,
if you're already over levered, you might as well be like do the Trump model of like 1000x over levered versus like 5x over levered.
No, like I didn't report to the lender, and if they ever hear this, I mean, I'd still be fine. But yeah, I mean, I provided the I provide construction loan guarantees. I don't believe I disclosed those. I don't think they asked for them. So
yeah,
I don't feel dishonest by that. If they asked for them,
so you could. So as long as you bounce around lenders, you could play and you get lenders comfortable with this idea of with whatever this model that this bank did, then you feel like it's a replicable model from a debt financing side.
So the rub is like we had to pledge a portion of the collateral from our like investment accounts, like E-Trade, right?
Got it.
There's that delta in the collateral between like the value of the fleet and the rest of the loan, right?
Right.
And being
like the goodwill, right?
Out of staters from California. Yeah. Being out of staters from California, they wanted some like easy access to, you know, collateral. And so at some point, like we don't have unlimited funds in our E-Trade, right? So if each bank is going to ask for a pledged amount, that is disclosed, right? And
what was the percentage? What was the percentage that you needed to pledge from that delta?
I think it was 80%, but remember, like divided by a third, right?
Uh-huh.
And then they gave us 100% value for the stocks, which I was surprised for too. So like usually they discount the value of your securities just due to volatility, but they didn't in this case.
You had to pay.
So that was pretty cool.
So like, just so I understand, assume that the book value of like the hard assets of the business on your balance sheet is $1 million, right?
Sure.
And then y'all are coming with $1 million of equity basically. So that $2 million delta, they wanted you to pledge 80% of that delta in collateral. And so that like sits into, that's basically an account that they have access to that like, if you default, they can liquidate. Like in terms of the mechanics of the pledge.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't like re-pledge that.
Like they don't,
you couldn't be like,
they don't, you say have access. Yeah. Like they don't have, when you say control or access, we have control over what we invest in, and I can sell and buy whatever, but it's sort of clear between me, E-Trade, and the lender that if they request it, you know, E-Trade is going to disperse funds to them for, you know, X amount or whatever.
And they wouldn't let you do like a letter of credit or anything that like you could potentially do in like a real estate deal where it's like some, you know, where typically like a bank will write you like a letter of credit to like, oh, it's fully, it's like freely callable. If like I've had to do that in leases before where I have a personal guarantee. And I've given the bank a letter of credit to try to get released from the personal guarantee where if it gets called, right, the bank funds it and it costs me like 5% of the letter of credit to like get the bank to write it.
Yeah, they weren't open to that.
They wanted something liquid.
they wanted something a little more. I think part of it was, and it goes back to the point you raised earlier, we're new to the space and we don't live in Arkansas, right? I mean, that's, so they don't want to have to like, I mean, had we lived there locally or in Louisiana, it'd be easier to connect on a lien or something, but they don't want to deal with it. They're a regional bank. They don't want to deal with the hassle of like waiting into the California courts to collect on some, you know, guarantee or something.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the rub there. I had a thought, but I can't remember what the thought was.
Well, I think maybe it'll come back to me, dude. I think the interesting part again, like You go, bro. We'll edit this. We can all post. We can post production. I mean, just interrupt the host right in the middle of it, bro. It's not a problem. It's your show. You take the show, bro. Whatever you need.
Sorry, bro. This is the Adam. This is the Adam Decker. I'm the Pharaoh of FedEx, dude.
You take the show, bro.
Please, man. Give me the mic. No. It's also like the pledged amount, right? Like we sort of have a handshake agreement with them that, like, you know, after 6 to 8 months performance, that's going away.
Got it.
And so that's part of the value of doing business with like a regional bank where it's very relationship focused. It meant a lot to them that I flew out to Shreveport, met with them in person. We were willing to do the pledge, and you know, they wouldn't sign the pledge collateral aspect, but they were like, look, if you guys are like good on your payments for, you know, 6 to 8 months or so, like, first of all, the loan amount's going to be decreasing, right? I mean, we're paying $50,000 a month to them. It's a 7-year amortization schedule. So like $30,000 a month is going down to principal payout.
Right.
It's like, that's significant, you know, like that's a significant amount. And so like over time, you know, they get more and more comfortable as it goes on. So it could be a scenario where like in a year or two, maybe we can do another loan with this same bank just because of our past performance, right?
Yeah. And so from currently if your loan is $50,000, you're making 80, I guess you're making 83 profit. So like the numbers are basically post debt pay down, you have 25, 30 a month in net that you could either distribute or keep in the business or do whatever. That's the basic numbers.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Which is dope.
That's the basic numbers. So like top line, we're getting $60,000 a week, roughly. Right. Awesome. So that's like $250,000 a month. Right. And you're paying $50,000 a month to debt service. But like I said, your EBITDA is like, you know, a quarter of that. So, I mean, the numbers, there's a lot of cushion, right? Initially, our plan is to sort of keep it in there because we don't know, like, I'm not a trucking guy, dude. I went to law school. I mean, I can pretend to talk the talk, but kind of like I did in that antique shop. But it only goes so far. At some point, I need to like wake up and say, you know what, maybe it's good to have some cash in case we got to buy a new truck.
Right.
Or in case something really crazy happens with our motor. that I just didn't anticipate, right? So there's a little bit of that. I'm hoping after a few months we get more comfortable from that side, and I think we will. Yeah,
I think the two things that I think are interesting: one, you coming from a real estate background, and like really focusing on like the financeability, right, the bankability of the thing that you're purchasing, as opposed to trying to optimize for like, right, the cheapest price, right, which you're probably going to get something with messy books and like a seller that's like, I think a lot of people in the acquisition space, they want something where they feel like their elbow grease is going, like that they can capture a lot of their elbow grease because they're getting a cheap price because they're taking on a big project to manage. And the piece that gets missed that I think is important that you did differently, is like focusing on the bankability of the business first, or having it be like a primary factor of it. And like, it's okay to potentially overpay or like pay a higher multiple relative to industry standards or whatever, because like, because it shows in the quality of the asset, which makes it more bankable, which makes it easier to operate, blah, blah, blah. And the other thing that's interesting, because you haven't come from a background like I came from, where I started my business from scratch and I did, and I built every process. And so a lot of times, like I mostly focus right now on like, on not full acquisitions, like partial ownership interest acquisitions, because I hate operations so much, because I've done it for 5 years. And I'm like, like that's like when you talk to me about a FedEx business, I'm like, I can just imagine like that guy's gonna quit. And then like, I'm about to like fly out to Shreveport.
Just stresses
and, like,
you out.
Freaking like change the oil in a truck, like all for like 10 grand a month. Like I'm out, you know what I mean? And so like, I've become, it's closed my mind to a lot of potential opportunities. Because I'm thinking about how am I supposed to operate this when everyone else leaves? Because that's what I've had to experience in my own entrepreneurial journey. And so I think it's cool you coming from a more deal background, less operationally intensive. And so you're not nearly as jaded as I am about having to like operate something. And yours is probably closer to the reality of what it can be, especially if you're buying into like a franchise system or something where there's like, where it's like highly structured.
Yeah.
Like the chances of you having to go out and do that is low. And so it's something that like, I know for just myself, like I have to reframe that for me. Cause like, I look at things, I'm like, nope, I'm going to have to operate it. I'm out. Like, I don't care what the cash flow is. I don't care about the debt. None of it. Like,
yeah.
Just cause like, that's been that, cause that's what happens when you're starting something from scratch all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's so it. So this is a great question, because there's like a lot of times where I'm like, I'll get an email from a driver, you know, asking about, hey, I think I got that I-9 in, did you do my E-Verify? You know, and it's sort of like, shit, what am I doing? You know, like, I don't want to be doing this. You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
But it's part, and this, that whole world is new to me, because in our real estate business, we don't have employees. We just, we pay the architect or we pay the lawyer, but they're all in outside firms. And so you just pay them, you know? And so it's different. It's new to actually have employees, but we're learning. I think one thing my brother and I are thinking about is like, you know, with this small business, we have a manager in place to do boots on the ground stuff day to day. But the prior owner, since he had four different businesses, he had scale large enough to justify like an in-house bookkeeper, an in-house recruiter, an in-house
operations guy.
For sure. Like, and we just don't have the scale yet to do that. And so Joseph and I are sort of taking on a lot of that stuff. But I think if we acquire another one or another two, right, we'll have enough to justify hiring someone full time to be like, yo, make sure that our license plates are up to date, you know, and make sure the employees are on board properly, that sort of a thing. So I think we'll get there, but you got to start somewhere.
did the seller pitch it as like, this is a very passive business for me? Like, I do nothing. This is like so seller, this is so owner passive. And you're coming in and understanding the reality of, or did you come in kind of like eyes wide open of like, yeah, this is going to be a little bit of a grind. Like, it's not, I'm not going to like make what I want to make per hour, like working on this on the front end, but like it'll all work itself out over time.
It's probably a little bit of both, you know, candidly. And like the seller's a good guy, but like now that we're in it, it's clear like he was running some expenses, you know, totally, through his parent company.
For sure.
Right. That weren't on the books of the actual company we acquired. And so, you know, he represented like, you know, the financials were accurate. They were, but a lot of the day-to-day administrative stuff was all expensed through the parent, which we didn't see. So we're having to pick that up now. And so it's a little bit of both. He wasn't dishonest by withholding that, but it's something I didn't realize till after we acquired, like, oh yeah, that's why you had that, that parent company.
And I had a business structure similar to that. And as a seller, like played a game similar to that from a book standpoint. And again, I think that there's some of those things that I've experienced in building something and exiting it that is kind of like, again, I'm probably like overly jaded in the like, in the acquisition, in acquiring things where the operational responsibility falls to me, which is why I love to partner with people that are okay operating or like taking a partial stake in a founder that wants to continue operating, but wants to take a little bit of money off the table just cause that operate at the small business acquisition side, right? When you're buying, like you're buying below private equity standards where they're wanting a platform of like a team that's going to go and like run the growth playbook, right? I think that's one of the hardest pieces is just like getting yourself comfortable with the operations. And also when you have a job like yours, where you make a lot of money, just maybe not as consistently as you would like, being okay, like doing things that really aren't worth your time on like an hourly basis and like being okay to like kind of eat shit and from an operational standpoint from time to time.
Yeah. Well, and look, I think eventually I like the FedEx space, having been into it, in it for all of 6 weeks.
Yeah. Honeymoon phase.
So I think we want to scale up and buy another business or two. And so I think eventually we'll be in a position where we'll have at least one or two people on staff kind of handling this administrative side of things. But even if I want to be an effective manager of those people, I feel like I got to like understand how to onboard an employee and make sure I do e-verify, right? Like it's I'm not going to pretend that like that's below me. It's like, you got to sort of know what you're asking people to do.
For sure.
So,
I think that's good. I think, I think it's awesome. I think it's an awesome deal. So you like the idea of staying in kind of the FedEx vertical and like pursuing something that's within that vertical to try to build a little conglomerate deal more than like, I got a FedEx thing onto the next space.
Like, I don't know, like standing from where I am right now, I don't know if our goal is to like build it and sell it and get some multiple expansion. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, or if the play is just pay off the loan and cash flow, right? Like,
was there multiple?
Like, I'm kind of open to both.
Was there multiple expansion from y'all to from like buyer buying it or seller buying it to y'all buying it, or multiple?
For sure.
There was.
Yeah, like it's gone from, I mean, even in the last 5 years, it's gone from high two to, you know, low fours. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's pretty substantial. And at some point you're going to run out of like multiple expansion there. You know, it's not Twitter or it's not some like internet
growth
company there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's that. I mean, I'm also fine because I'm taking on so much risk in the real estate space as a developer. I'm fine if it's just, let's just hold it and let's just cash flow. And that way, if you have an off year in real estate or the market's in the tank and you just you just don't have any deals, right? I don't want to be in a position where I like, not that I like hated the law firm, but like, I just don't want to be forced to go back to a job.
Totally.
Now that sure. I've like been outside of it for a while, like
freedom.
Yeah. And so I want to be able to have the flexibility and not be forced to do a job that I don't want. Anyway, yeah.
And I think you said something at the very beginning that's important. Like this has been one of the hardest things where I typically force myself to like start a new company or like look for acquisitions. Like, right. For me, one of the hardest parts of being an investor or a deal person is the psychology of like wanting to feel progress and like wanting to get into a deal just for like the action of it. And so it's kind of nice to have,
yeah.
to like force yourself to have some I-9s and really like take the edge off from like really like knock you down a few pegs energy wise.
Yeah.
And like slightly entrepreneurially tired. So that way, like it helps you. I feel like it helps you have a higher threshold of like deals that you're going to allow onto your plate. Cause you're going to be like stressed yeah. out about like, shit, my freaking FedEx bit. It's like, no, I'm not doing like a media yeah. for real estate deal. Cause I got to like fly out to Shreveport and like hire a new manager.
Yeah. No. And it's like, you even see it like in the last, I mean, I'm in Ventura County, California. It's like a supply constrained market. Right. But like land prices have gone bonkers. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, a deal that looked very compelling 18 months ago. Now it's like, it's tough to make it pencil unless you're really making some bold assumptions on what you're going to lease it for on the back end.
Totally.
And so like, it's like, do you really want to be forced to do something that makes you uncomfortable or do you just want to like kind of be patient and find the deals that you know you're going to crush? Meanwhile, kind of funding your lifestyle with this FedEx route. So
yeah.
Yeah.
This will be my last question for you. What do you think, what's your current climate as things are like in massive flux with inflation, interest rates, Fed, what is the Decker crystal ball say? I'm sure this comment will age well. We'll replay this in 5 years and we'll see. I guess it's a two part question and I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to anyway. Actually no, answer that. I gotta
take notes. It's like A, B, C,
its own law school exam.
Yeah. Are you asking me as the Pharaoh of FedEx or as a real estate developer, dude?
Both. Just like generally, so general, because the second part of my question is kind of like your general, macro econ opinion and like whether the FedEx thing like really matched that, or it's just kind of like, yeah, I think macro there's this, but like on a micro, like Shreveport, like let's not sit in the green lounge and like try to predict, you know, what the Fed is going to do. And like, let's just bank 10 grand a month and call it good.
Yeah. For the audience, the Green Lounge is, it's the lobby in the law school where Raleigh and I would basically sit and talk about our brilliant schemes without
talk about that. So when you're starting, like when we start the hedge fund, like I wonder like,
exactly. Now, as the Pharaoh of FedEx, right? I mean, it's interesting why FedEx is why they structured it this way. I mean, you can see it. There's some frustration among contractors because gas prices are high. There's clearly been a run up in labor prices, yeah. And it's almost impossible to find new trucks right now. And so it's like it's not easy being a contractor. And so contractors are asking for more money from FedEx. If they were doing all of this in-house, there'd be a union and FedEx wouldn't have as much control over the negotiation.
Totally.
But now they kind of hold a lot of the cards, right? And so I expect FedEx will raise its rates a little bit. They do every year in the fall. But I don't know that it's going to be as much as contractors are hoping. But I still think... At least I am not concerned about operating my FedEx business for the next 2-3 years in this environment, because there's already baked in so much cushion into our business.
Yeah.
And I just don't see, I mean, I get it. People are going to start buying fewer goods online, but it's not like it's going to zero, dude. I mean,
yeah,
that habit is not going to stop, right?
People, you feel like people are going to buy fewer goods online because COVID brought that demand forward and now people want experiences, or because last mile is going to get dev'd out perfectly?
I think it's less about the COVID dynamic, more about just like maybe consumers have less discretionary spending.
Oh, got it. Inflation's going to make it so.
Yeah, like wages aren't catching up with inflation, right? And so like, and like shipping costs are going through the roof, so it's going to cost more and more to buy crap online.
Totally.
And so I think that might slow some e-commerce, but I'm not super concerned like that it's going to go to zero. Now, if you play this back in 5 years, maybe
no, it doesn't go. There's no way that it goes to zero. That's crazy. E-com.
Yeah.
E-com. No, I don't think, I think when you're looking at acquisitions, you can like try to thread too many needles and like basically sit on the sideline for forever of like, does this fit like my economic outlook and my like core competency and my margin of safety and the like whatever. At some point, like, you got to just feel comfortable enough and like pull the trigger, and there's going to be 20% of stuff that you have no idea about, and you're going to end up having to do I-9s, you know, one weekend out of every 3 months, but like at least you're like in the game figuring it out, you know.
Yeah. No, and the way, like, one technical note, like the way that our contracts are structured with FedEx is they are dedicated guaranteed runs. So like I could care less how many goods are in each of the trailers that I'm hauling. All I care is that like FedEx is saying, okay, Adam, like, yeah, you have the right to drive from Little Rock to Dallas and back 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
And that's all I really care about. Right. And so from that perspective, I'm fine. I guess now we can pivot to real estate. Obviously, my exposure is to Southern California industrial real estate. And so like, if I'm going to speak to that, I'm not crazy concerned. I think industrial,
'cause you're core.
Yeah. Like like the market is so supply constrained.
Yeah.
That it's like, even in this environment where interest rates are coming up, like I don't see demand for warehouses going anywhere in the foreseeable future.
Where you're at, because you're in the center of the center of the center.
Now, if I'm building offices in Topeka, Kansas, you know, like,
or in the
maybe I got to rethink.
Tex, what is it again? Architect archipelago.
The Arkalatex, bro. Yeah.
The Arkalatex.
Yeah. It was super funny. I was driving around with the prior owner, and he was telling me about. He was like, Adam. He's from Mississippi. He's like, Adam, you seem like a funny guy, man. This year we call it the Arkalatex. I'm going to get you a shirt that says, I survived the Arkalatex. Sounds like a dinosaur, don't it? Yeah. So
just doing deals and getting rich in the Arkalatex, bro. That's what I love.
Yeah, that's
beautiful.
Yeah. So from a warehouse perspective, I feel comfortable like where I'm at. Construction prices are crazy. And so if I'm building spec, I feel fine. I have learned the hard way that I'm not interested in fixed price build-to-suit agreements in an inflationary environment where I'm taking all the construction cost risk, but none of the upside on the back end.
Totally.
So as long as I'm like structuring my deals properly, right? Like I'm feeling fine. But again, like I don't know that I could say the same about housing or office or retail for that matter. I mean, those are all sort of like out of my core competency, if you will.
Totally. No, I think that's I think that's that.
How about you, man? What's your outlook
on the economy?
Yeah, dude.
I think from a equity market standpoint, you know, stocks, I mean, because one thing is like, what's your outlook? And the other thing is like, what are you actually doing? And like, I'm probably like 90% in cash right now. I have like very little, I've kind of like, and again, I've kind of like sold out of everything that I had positions in. And I think right now my outlook is, or my strategy is like, I don't want to get into, I think we've been in a 12-year like risk on position where like you continue to get compensated very well to be in a risk on position. And I think that it'll be a very quick risk off position. And so I only like to be in things and do things where it's very simple to like find risk off, you know what I mean? So for me, what that takes out is like, you know, I don't want to start a new trampoline park business where I have a 15-year lease and like, I have like a long-term contract on something that like, we may be in a protracted risk off position, which is part of why I've moved to, doing more, like kind of startup because labor, you know, labor and kind of employees to build something like that can be risk off relatively quickly. But I also think it's wise. Like, I think something that where you're in, where it's just like very, very stable cash flow with a high margin of safety between like your debt ratio and what you're doing. Like, I think that is like, makes total sense. I hate, I don't want to be in e-com right now with like China supply chain stuff. And so, I just haven't like, I've basically like, you know, moved to,
well,
cash.
When you say e-com, like, you're talking like actual like product development. And cause with Carly's business, you're like creating products or sourcing them and then shipping to the consumer. That side, you're saying you want out of that. Yeah.
Yep. And I've basically shut that business down. That business right now is like, we're going on pause. Cause like what's happening in e-com world is like your cost to acquire customers from a marketing standpoint has doubled in the past year. And also like your like raw material costs have doubled in the past year. And so like a lot of e-com people, especially in like supplement space, if they're getting components or things from China, you know, there's just a massive vulnerability there. And if you're in the business of acquiring customers through advertising, particularly Facebook advertising, like anyone whose business has been marketing driven through Facebook advertising, like their customer acquisition costs have doubled over the past year. Like I'm sure somebody will hit me up on TikTok and leave a mean comment that's not true for them individually. But almost across the board, e-com is in like a, like I looked at a business of a guy that was doing $6 million a year pre updates to Facebook. He was making 30 grand a month. And over the past year, he's put at $6 million a year in top line, he's doing negative 450 grand a year net profit because he can't acquire customers profitably. And so like, I think from an investment standpoint, especially if I'm looking like e-com software, whatever, I think the risk off thing is like any business that has been compensated to drive growth through like negative unit economics, you know what I mean? Where it's like, we're going to lose money on the front end with this customer, but it's going to like pan out over time. Sure. I think all of those businesses for the next 2 to 3 years, like I'm out on all of those things. Like you have to have like positive front end unit economics, customer acquisition stuff, or else like it's just the wrong market. You know what I mean?
You'll probably see like a coalescing around like existing brands that totally already have like infrastructure built.
For
you
sure.
Know, like, yeah.
That yeah. Makes it'll, sense. It'll be yeah. like all the weak ones die. Cause like,
right.
Which is why I'm trying, which is why I look for audiences, look for products and businesses that are built around community, right? Where there's a community aspect. Cause with community aspect, you can drive like organic profitable growth in the business, in a way that you can't do without community. So like, that's like, that's a non-answer. I kind of like avoided everything. Right. Like, but sure. Cause like, I think interest rates go up. Right. And I think like, and I think the correlations that have always existed between the real estate stock market, you know, in terms of being inversely correlated to interest rate, I think those things, like, I think those stay. And I think there are pockets that it won't be true. But the way I think, but that's like my natural tendency is to be kind of a bear. And so I'm like an optimistic bear. Cause I have to like check myself. Cause I always think like the sky is falling. And, so like, I gave you a non-answer. So that way this is going to age perfectly.
No. you've predicted, you know, 10 of the last.
Yeah, 10 of the last one, yeah. 10 of the last recession, 10 of the last yeah. two recessions.
So, right. Cool, man.
Well, bro,
this has been awesome, dude.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for being on the pod. I'm going to do like,
absolutely.
Where should people hit you up? Where's the best place to find you to get Twitter? Are you still Twitter active?
I'm like, I'm less active on Twitter. Twitter, Adams, yeah, at Adam Z Decker, dude.
Okay, we'll put it. We'll
you can
put
hit
it
me
in.
Up on Twitter, LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Those are probably the two best spots. Yeah, Twitter and LinkedIn.
Dope. We'll put it in the
show notes or something.
We'll put it in the show notes.